for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, maybe they're getting ready to get out of town. This is very interesting. The governor of Alto Paraguay, Erasmo Rodriguez Acosta, has admitted to hearing that George Bush Sr. owns land in the Chaco region of Paraguay in Paso de Patria. Acosta says that rumor has it that Bush owns near 70,000 hectares, that's 173,000 acres, as part of an ecological reserve and or ranch. Very interesting. This is supposedly Timothy Towle, the U.S. ambassador in Asunción, the capital of Paraguay, is the present administrator of the land. So is this sparking the interest in the property? May have been Jenna Bush's private visit to Paraguay with UNICEF, which started back in October. Supposedly, Jenna will travel to the ranch to observe several indigenous villages that are now located on what may be the estate of the Bush family. What, if the impeachment begins? Who knows? Anyhow, welcome to our program. Tom Hartman here with you. 7 minutes past the hour, the first of three on this beautiful day. And we have with us John Cox. He is the first Republican who has announced that he's running for president of the United States in 2008. He's an attorney, a CPA, a real estate broker, an investment advisor who manages portfolios exceeding $50 million. His website, if you are curious about his candidacy or would like to support his candidacy, Cox2008. That's Cox2008.com. John Cox, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Thank you, Tom. I'm having a little bit of a problem hearing you, but we'll try to do our best.
Okay. If the folks in New York can do anything to crank up your volume, I'm sure they are working on it right now. And if not, I'll just try to talk louder. How's that?
No, don't talk louder. Talk softer. There we go. Okay.
Oh, is that? Well, that's it. Okay. All right. Well, John Cox, why are you running for president as a Republican?
Well, I've been a Republican for about 25 years. Ronald Reagan brought me to the Republican Party. I grew up a Democrat. My mother was a Chicago public school teacher. She was in love with John F. Kennedy. She thought he was the greatest president ever. I grew up a Democrat. Ran for delegate to the Democrat convention in 1976, as a matter of fact. But I became a CPA and started working for people who were paying tax at 70%, which didn't give a lot of incentive for people to earn more money, which I felt would grow the economy and create more opportunities for people. So I believed in the Reagan philosophy. Why am I running right now? Because I don't see a Ronald Reagan out there who is going to capture the hearts and minds of the American people and a lot of Democrats who I think voted for Ronald Reagan because they believed in a lot of the Reagan ideals. They believed that government wasn't the answer to all of our problems. Government was the problem. And that's not this president right now, to be honest. Looking at what's gone on the last 5 or 6 years with the increase in spending, the increase in government, I'm one of those conservative Republicans out there who believes that we need to have a change in that philosophy.
So, John, it seems like the basis of your candidacy is economic. I'm curious, how can you suggest that what Ronald Reagan did and what George W. Bush has done in following his fiscal policy of tax cuts makes any sense when let me finish my question here.
Sure.
When right now, your share, your personal share, well, how many people are in your family, if you don't mind my asking?
I have four daughters, a wife, and a female dog.
Okay, so basically there's six people in your family. So your share of the national debt, family of six, right now is $171,137.91. And of that $171,000 that your family owes, mostly to China and Japan, by the way, of that $171,000 that your family owes, about $140,000 of it was run up by Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush. Now,
yeah, great.
Now, that's insane. And they ran it up so that they could give tax cuts to the people that you say need tax cuts. I mean,
well,
that was the consequence of those tax cuts, was an explosion of debt.
Can I respond? Can
Please.
I respond? All right, I'm a CPA, so I understand a little bit about business. I understand a little bit about the economy, okay? I've been in business for 30 years. First of all, Reagan did run up a lot of spending, no question about it. He did it by building up a huge military increase, which I believe, and we can certainly have a rational disagreement, but I believe that resulted in the Soviet Union spending themselves into bankruptcy and us winning the Cold War without firing a shot. Now, Reagan...
It's a nice fantasy. I mean, you know, the fact of the matter is that the CIA was predicting that the USSR would implode years before Reagan came into office.
Well, you know,
and they didn't implode on Reagan's watch, by the way. They imploded on Jerry Ford's or on George Herbert Walker Bush's.
Of course, but certainly it happened within a couple of years after Reagan left. But here's the point. The point is the Reagan tax cuts also did the job in terms of increasing economic growth and generating more investment and generating the creativity and the innovation and the private entrepreneurship.
Well, let me ask you a question.
The economy. Now that happened again with George Bush this time, and you know, whatever you believe, the reason that we're showing a reduced deficit right now is because the economy has grown, businesses.
There's no such thing as a reduced deficit.
I'm sorry?
There's no such thing as a reduced deficit. If you're in debt, you're in debt.
Well, I agree with you. And by the way,
number one. And number two, the average economic growth.
Tom, one of the reasons I'm running is because I am as horrified as you are about the deficit. I absolutely do not want to leave my children a $9 trillion debt, Tom. I totally agree with you. One of the reasons I'm running is because I think that's immoral. And I decry the Republican Congress's, you know,
but
failure.
But let's look at the reality. Okay, and I agree with that.
I just don't think the Democrats are going to be anything different in that respect.
Yeah,
I
get it. And I don't think either of us yelling over each other is going to help the debate.
No,
either.
I'm sorry.
The fact of the matter is that if you look at economic growth in the United States continuously since the Great Depression, I mean, we can pull that out to make it reasonable. It has averaged 3.2% a year. Economic growth in the United States.
Okay.
George W. Bush has only had 1 year out of the last six in which we have had economic growth above 3.2%. His average has been around 1.8.
No, that's wrong, actually. Your numbers are off. I just saw a study this morning that showed that the average economic growth over the last 5-6 years has been something like 3.2, 3.3. So I don't know where you get your numbers from, but they're just wrong. I'm sorry. Go ahead. I'm an investment advisor, by the way. I manage money. That's what I do for a living. So,
maybe we're talking apples and oranges here. Maybe we're using different numbers. I don't know, but I don't think that the average American would agree that they're better off now than they were when George Bush came into office. The average billionaire would, certainly, and the average millionaire would. But here's the question: when Ronald Reagan did his tax cuts. Well, here, let me frame this in a way that I think everybody can get. If I give you a credit card that has $1 million line of credit and say, here you go, John Cox, johncox2008.com, here you go, John Cox, have a good time. You're going to be able to live large, and it's going to look like you've got a really good thing going, but it's my credit card. What happens when I come back to you a few years later and say, okay, John, now pay me back?
Okay, can I respond?
I mean, that's what Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush have done. You say to the extent to which they've stimulated the economy, it's been entirely on debt. What do we do?
Can I respond? First
sure.
of all, Ronald Reagan ran up a big debt with the military buildup, no question, and he didn't do enough to rein in Congress in terms of the spending either, and I agree with
his
you
military
on that.
His military buildup, John, only accounted for about 20% of the debt that he ran up.
Please.
Most of it was the result of his tax cuts.
Let me respond, please, Tom. So absolutely, he ran up a debt. Now, during that same time frame, the stock market gained $40 trillion or $35 trillion, something like that, in value during the 80s. As anybody would know, in business, you incur debt to increase your income, you're doing a good thing. It's when you incur debt that doesn't grow your business, doesn't grow your income, you're doing a bad thing.
But the stock market is not the wealth of the United States. It's the wealth of stockholders. And
which
the debt
of
the United States, no, it's
which
not.
All of us. Sure it is. Sure it is. There's 40
David is sitting next to me here. He doesn't own any stock whatsoever. The stock market does not reflect his wealth. However, he does owe $28,523.07 because of the federal government's debt.
I disagree with you, Tom. Tom, the stock market is in everybody's 401k. There's 40 million Americans that are walking around that have 401ks.
So 40 million out of the 300 million of us. I mean,
that's just the people with 401ks. Wait a minute, Tom. The stock market is also in every union pension plan, and I know the investment managers for a lot of these unions. The stock market is in every union pension plan, and that's a lot of the rest of the people. So every worker in this country has a stake in the stock market. It's just not true to say that we don't, that only the rich have a stake in the stock market.
Okay. All righty, John, we got to wrap it up there, but you make a good case.
Thank you.
if somebody wants to believe it. Yeah, Cox2008.com, the website for John Cox, the first Republican to have declared his candidacy for president in 2008. Good luck, John. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I want to be America. My daddy used to know. Where right was right and not political code. Where leaders in D.C. still respected you and me. The America my daddy taught to me.
And welcome back to the place where smart people get their news. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Yes, it's absolutely incredible. This is, just do the math on this for a minute. If you have $550 billion, that's 550,000 million, and you divide that by a million, now you get all those zeros in there. It's really easy to get confused. I'll just do it easy for you. 550 billion divided by a million is 550,000. So if you say that you're going to create 1 million jobs with a $550 billion tax cut, you're saying that you're going to give tax cuts to the tune of $550,000 per job. Now, does that make sense? I'm going to create a job down at Burger King, pays $12,000 a year. Well, I don't know what Burger King pays. Let's say they're generous. That pays $18,000 a year. And in order to create that job, I'm going to give a rich guy $550,000 in tax cuts. Now, do you think anybody could get elected on a platform as insane as that? We're going to give tax cuts of $550 billion to create 1 million new jobs. $550,000 per job. It sounds loony, doesn't it?
With a robust package of at least $550 billion in across-the-board tax relief, we will help create more than a million new jobs.
And here's the tragedy. Bush's tax cut of $550 billion did create a million new jobs. In Mexico and China! It's like, what? Now, what these guys will say is, Reagan, he had a tax cut and that stimulated the economy. Well, yeah, sort of. Reagan borrowed trillions of dollars. Ronald Reagan in his 8 years borrowed more money in your name and mine than every president from George Washington to Ronald Reagan combined, even when you take them into current dollars. The money that George Washington borrowed from the French to fight the Revolutionary War, the money that James Madison borrowed to fight the War of 1812 against the Brits, the money that Abraham Lincoln borrowed to fight the Civil War, the war that McKinley and Teddy Roosevelt borrowed to fight the Spanish-American War, the money that Wilson borrowed to fight World War I, the money that Roosevelt borrowed to fight World War II, the money that Truman borrowed to fight the Korean War, the money that LBJ and Nixon borrowed to fight the Vietnam War. Add it all together. Every president from George Washington to Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan in 8 years borrowed more money in your name and mine than every other president in history combined. Now, I'm telling you, if I go out and borrow $5, $10, $15, $20 million and spend it, you'd look at me and go, hey, that guy's living large. Must be a good economy for Mr. Hartman. And it would, until a bill comes due. And that bill is coming due, my friends. It's coming due on our children and grandchildren. But, these cons say, back when Jack Kennedy cut taxes from 90%, the top marginal tax rate from 90% down to 70%, it increased revenue in the federal government. Well, yeah, it did, because Kennedy actually increased taxes. Kennedy pointed out that nobody was paying the 90% tax rate, and he ought to know. He was in that tax bracket. He said the most anybody's paying is 50, 60% because there's all these loopholes. So we're going to close these loopholes. Here's what Kennedy said.
Yes, I have stated in both the debates and state again that I believe in a balanced budget and have supported that concept during my 14 years in the Congress.
And that's why he wanted to raise taxes, was to balance the budget.
The only two times when an unbalanced budget is warranted would be during a serious recession, and we had that in 58 and an unbalanced budget of $12 billion, or a national emergency where there should be large expenditures for national defense, which we have in World War II and during part of the Korean War.
So then he comes right out and says, I'm going to increase tax revenues. We're going to increase revenues.
Third, I think it's possible to gain a $700 million to $1 billion through tax changes, which I believe would close up loopholes on dividend withholding, on expense accounts.
See, we're going to get, he's going to raise taxes by $1 billion by closing loopholes. Yes, they closed the top, they reduced the top marginal rate, so now everybody actually pays that 70%.
So in my judgment, we would spend more money in this administration on aid to education, we'd spend more money on housing, we'd spend more money, and I hope more wisely, on defense than this administration has done. But I believe that the next administration should work for a balanced budget, and that would be my intention. Mr. Nixon mistakes my figures constantly, which is, of course, his right. But the fact of the matter is, here is where I stand, and I just want to have it on the public record.
Yeah. Jack Kennedy actually raised taxes. And, gee, he raised taxes, and there was more revenue for the federal government. Reagan cut taxes, and it threw the federal government into so much debt that this year, we're spending almost $180 billion in tax money, which is enough money to put, I believe, about 10 million kids through college, about $180 billion, just on the interest that Reagan, just on the interest on the money that Reagan borrowed. We're paying. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me the truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politics. All I want is the truth. Just
and welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you by Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time. SacredGroundsCoffee.com, their website, 1-800-425-2532, their phone number, and they're running a special sale right now for the autumn season, for the fall season. Just type fall into the coupon field at checkout to claim your savings at SacredGroundsCoffee.com, or give them a call at 1-800-425-2532. 35 minutes past the hour. We're back. Boy, a lot going on here. This economic stuff, just this makes me crazy when I hear these conservatives going on about, we've got it all figured out. It's just fine. George W. Bush borrowed zillions of dollars. Well, actually, trillions of dollars. We're up to a national debt right now of, let's see, as of this moment, $8,557,497,158,500. Whoops, it just became $498,896. It's climbing at the rate of about $1 million, it seems. Well, I'll tell you, it's right now $8,557,498,000. Now it's $499 million. I'm watching the debt clock. You can see this thing over at uwsa.com/uwsa-usdebt.html, or just Google national debt clock. It just became $500 billion. 500 million. So we just added another million. So just since I started talking about it, we've added $3 million to the U.S. debt. That's money, it just went to 501 million. That's money that you and I owe. And it's being borrowed at that rate right now by George W. Bush and spent by the Republicans in Congress in order to make the economy look good. But anybody who's rational knows that when you borrow money and spend it, the look good part of the economy is an illusion. This is in particular because we're not using that money to invest in the infrastructure that's necessary to build prosperity. Franklin Roosevelt borrowed money to get us out of the Great Depression. But he put that money into infrastructure. If you borrow money and you use it to build schools, you borrow that money and you use it to build highways, you build it to build, use it to build bridges, to build airports, you're building the industrial infrastructure of the nation, and that infrastructure returns an investment. If you've got a road that costs you $100 million to put in, over the 30-year productive lifespan of that road, or 20 years, or whatever it may be, you're going to get far more than $100 million back from it in terms of the commerce that can be conducted over it. That's an investment. That's not an expense. It's an investment. But what these guys are doing is borrowing money to put it into military. We now have a Pentagon budget over $500 billion annually. It's larger than the entire budget of the United States was just a few decades ago. And when you put money into the military, you don't get that money back. That money just vanishes into space. Why? Because, well, you build a bomb, you drop the bomb on somebody. Where's the money? It just blew up. This is incredible. It's just incredible that anybody can even make these arguments. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Ira driving in Virginia. And we're going to hang on just a second here, Ira. We are going to get to this whole issue of what's happening in Ohio and other states with regard to the really, as Greg Pallas sent me a note this morning, he says this is just a variation on caging, which he broke that story for the BBC back in the 2000 election.
Yeah.
The theft of the election. So we'll get back to that in a few minutes. But first, I want to just wrap up some of this economic stuff. Ira, driving in Virginia. Hey, Ira.
Hey. Look, this trickle-down economic stuff, I mean, this is BS. You know, when you give influence and power to the rich, you have to take it from the poor. And when you do it on credit, you just compound the effect. And the evidence is the loss of unions, loss of jobs, and loss of economic power of the working people.
Yeah, we've had 26 years now of trickle-down economics. There was a brief punctuation in that where Bill Clinton actually balanced the budget. But basically, we've had 26 years of trickle-down economics, and what has it brought us? It's brought us, we've gone from 25% of the United States workforce being unionized when Reagan came into office in 1980 or 81, down to about 7.5% of the private workforce now. The loss of union jobs, the loss of security, the loss of pensions, the loss of good-paying jobs. Now two people have to work in a family to maintain the same standard of living that could be maintained by one person working in the family back in 1980. I mean, it's been a complete sea change as a consequence of this, what George Herbert Walker Bush, who actually understood this stuff, even though he got trapped in it, called voodoo economics.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Ira, thank you very much.
Yeah,
I appreciate it. Tom in Toledo, Ohio. Hey, Tom, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. Great to talk to you. Listen, I'm a political organizer for a labor union up here in Toledo, Ohio. This is the first time I've ever done this stuff. I'm on
a two-month absence.
Yeah, thank you. Well, you're responsible for it in part by saying, tag, you're it. That's what we had to, so I decided to do it.
Well, thank you. Good.
Yeah, and I'm really enjoying it. I wanted to say that part of what I'm doing up here is to arrange for several screenings of the movie Iraq for Sale.
Right.
And one of the main screenings is going to be on Monday, the 30th of October.
Uh-huh.
And in the main library in downtown Toledo, the Toledo Lucas County main library at the McMaster Center, which is a beautiful facility, seats about 200. And I just wanted to give a shout out to all the Toledoans who are listening to come and
be sure to show up. There you go, Tom. And over at commondreams.org, there's a link to where you can buy the movie if you want for $12. I mean, you can buy a CD of it. But it's absolutely great to go to these screenings. Robert Greenwald actually came here to Portland, and I showed up at the screening that he did here, and it was really nice to have him do a Q&A afterwards. He's the guy, of course, who made the movie. And it's a shocking, stunning. I mean, after you're done watching this thing, you just walk out with your jaw on the floor. Oh, my God, that's what it's all about. Look at all this money that these guys have made on this thing.
Yeah,
the movie's Iraq for Sale.
Yeah, it's a really heartfelt movie, and I tell you, I mean, if you don't come away from the movie with, you know, feeling very sad and shocked and disgusted and angry, I mean, you have a cold heart. That's all there is to it.
Yeah. Well, so Tom, thanks a lot for the call. I got to move along here, but I appreciate you calling in today. Chuck in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Hey, Chuck, what's on your mind today?
Tom, I was just when I was listening to the Cox 2008 talking about Reagan, Jimmy Carter's energy policies, and this was in an article in Foreign Affairs in 1992 during the presidential campaign, actually contributed $150 billion a year to the economy in those dollars, in those 1992 dollars, and they expired in 86 under the Reagan watch. And those,
right.
We were really almost virtually energy self-sufficient.
We were moving rapidly in that direction, and that's a great example, Chuck, because what Carter was doing was he was saying, okay, we're going to use tax credits and tax deductions and basically tax dollars, although it's tax credits and tax deductions, in order to encourage people to build their own infrastructure, that is to make their home more efficient, to put a passive solar collector on the roof or an active solar, you know, whatever it may be, and that infrastructure produced returns on that investment that was much greater than the cost of the tax.
And it was disposable income, too, for people to use, and that drove the economic engine, you know, and rather than borrow it.
Yeah.
You know, and it creates jobs, and Gore proved that it could create jobs. He did a lot of work while in the Clinton White House saving energy and military installations, federal installations.
Yep.
It's just amazing, you know, how the Democrats, like you're saying, Roosevelt, Kennedy, they all seem to contribute to the domestic well-being. And, you know, Reagan, when he got out of office, the Japanese gave him $2 million to take a tour. He made them so much money.
Yeah, and Reverend Moon's giving him money to give speeches in Korea. And, yeah, it's really sad to see these guys, these Republicans, leave office and then just cash in so big. And it's really noble to see Jimmy Carter going out there with Habitat for Humanity. Chuck, I got to move along. I appreciate the call. Paula in Carbondale, Indiana. Is that Indiana or Illinois?
Illinois.
Yeah, so you're listening to WINI.
Yes, I am.
One of our very first radio station affiliates back from almost 4 years ago. Great. Hey, Paul.
It's a great radio station. I enjoy it.
It is.
Well, originally I called to say some things make me crazy about, you know, this whole memory hole thing. We're all supposed to remember that Ronald Reagan was so great. I'm glad you don't do that. But one thing he did when he lowered the income tax, supposedly, he told all us baby boomers back when we were young that we had to build a trust fund for our old age. So he raised the Social Security taxes back then, if you'll remember, in the 80s.
He almost doubled them.
And we have been paying into that trust fund, so to speak, for the last 30 years, and there should be $1 trillion in it, and now they're telling us, there's no trust fund. You people need to be responsible for yourself.
Right.
Where's your 401ks, which is a farce, as that guy brought up. Oh, we are all stock owners.
Yeah.
I've been paying into my 401k for 12 years now, and I have $9,000. Boy, that's going to make for a good old age.
Yeah, really. That's a great example, Paul. What's so amazing is that Reagan, first of all, it was Greenspan, and who was former senator from New York or Connecticut, who was the other guy in the
Javits?
They had this commission on Social Security, and they said, this generation, the baby boomers, are going to be the first generation that's not only going to pay for the retirement of their parents with Social Security, because, you know, typically every year the income matches the outgo, but they're also going to pay for their own. We're going to double the taxes on them, so
exactly.
They're going to save money for themselves, because it's the you know, the rabbit going through the python thing. They're going to pay for their own retirement, plus they're going to pay for their parents' retirement, and then when they all die off, we'll go back to people just paying for their parents' retirement. And we set that money aside, and Reagan had to borrow it because his tax cuts for the rich so bankrupted the government that he had to find a source for money, and that's why he started dipping into Social Security, and they still are. Paula, thank you so much for pointing that out. I appreciate the call. It's great to hear from you. 45 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
That's me at the pulpit. That's me in the spotlight, using my religion, trying to keep an eye on you. I'm repealing the Fourth Amendment. Oh no, I say.
better repeal the fifth one too. I know that I hear God speaking. I know that God works through me. So everything I do is good.
Yes, thank you, George. Welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We are, the laws of habeas corpus. We are going to, by the way, just a quick reminder for our listeners in San Francisco, quakeradio.com. You can get the free tickets for the great debate that's going to be happening a week from Saturday, the 27th. It'll be the 27th of October. And it's going to be eight of us here, four on the left, four on the right, debating. It's moderated by the Honorable Willie Brown, and it's free. So come be part of the cheering section, quakeradio.com. Check it out. Amazing stuff out here in the news. If I told you that Congress, this from Major Danby, if I told you that Congress was considering passing a law that gives the president, this president, the power in the event of any, quote, disaster, accident, or catastrophe, end quote, that he deems to require it to involuntarily take National Guard troops from, say, Alabama and send them to, say, California and require them to be there for up to a year and act on his behalf rather than that of the governor of California and do anything he wants. Would you be amazed? I would be. This is a violation of posse comitatus. It's a violation of a fundamental law that goes back to the Reconstruction era. But sure enough, it was built. That was passed 3 weeks ago by the U.S. Congress in the 2007 Defense Authorization Bill. So if there are people in the streets after the elections, George Bush now has the power to send in the National Guard. It won't be the local National Guard who might be reluctant to fire on their neighbors. It'll be out-of-state National Guard who will have much less reluctance, at least history shows. So anyhow, we're going to get back into that and into some of the issues that have to do with the theft of our vote and our elections as we continue through the program here today. But right now, let's just wrap this issue up. Anderson in Duval, Washington. Hey, Anderson, you think I'm wrong?
How you doing, Tom?
I'm fine. I'm great.
I'm responding to your comment earlier when you said the money spent on the military just vanishes into thin air.
Well, it's a bit of a generalization. The salaries for the military don't vanish into thin air.
Yeah.
You build a bomb and it does.
Saying, I wish that was true, but it's not true. The trouble is that money gets into the pockets of the military industrial contractor CEOs, the oil tycoon CEOs, and such and so forth. And then they use that money after they bought, their fourth or fifth mansion and their yachts and everything. They use that money to continue to manipulate the government, which in turn will grant them more contracts and more policies that only enrich them further.
Yeah.
And we pay for our life. It doesn't vanish in thin air, unfortunately. I mean, we'd be better off if this government sat on their dead ass and went fishing the whole time. They're spending their entire time plotting against us, and that's what they're doing. And you're right.
Yeah, you're right, Anderson. You're right, and I stand corrected. And the point that I was trying to make is that government spending can either be an investment, and if it's an investment, then there's actually a return. The government spends, for example, the government spends about $5,000 per year per child in the United States to educate our kids. We get back, we collectively, we the people, our government is us, we get back far more than the lifetime cost of education in terms of productivity of people in the economy. So that's an investment. We get a return on that investment. Or a government can expense things, and most military spending is an expense. But you're right, a lot of that expense money ends up in the pockets of the military industrial contractors, and then they're just cranking it around. You're absolutely right.
And just for a specific example, here in Seattle, one of the really big issues is the new viaduct. Everybody's afraid that the viaduct could fall down in an earthquake, and it's justifiable. They're talking $2 or $3 billion to rebuild or to build a tunnel, whatever. This is money that is being wasted in Iraq, and this Seattle's not unique. Every city has their infrastructure challenges, and the money that we're transferring from the middle class and from our own cities and communities, and it's going into the hands of a very few people who are going to use that money to simply continue this whole charade.
Yeah. And when you see Robert Greenwald's movie Iraq for Sale, you'll absolutely know that what you speak is the truth, Anderson. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Andrew in Springfield, Massachusetts. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm great, and thanks for listening. Is it WHMP there?
Yeah, WHMP, 1600 AM.
There you go.
Progressive Talk for Western Mass. Oh, what a great radio station.
I agree.
So much. thank you very much for doing what you're doing. Because, you know, I heard the other day that Air America is, you know, filing for Chapter 11, but I please stay on the air. Please.
Oh, this program is not going away no matter what happens. And frankly, I don't think Air America Radio is going to go away, but no matter what, this program is going to stick around. So.
All right. That's great, Tom. Okay.
So,
here's what
your question, your comment.
Okay.
Because we only have a minute left.
You were talking about Reagan, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I wanted to share with you a little story I had. I was a file clerk for a major, I'm not going to obviously name the corporation, but for a major national corporation earlier this summer. And I noticed something on my pay. When I you know, I'd work between 30 and 40 hours a week.
Yeah. You've got to get to the point here, Andrew, because we're out of time. I'm sorry.
And as it varied, as I... You know, the more hours I worked, the less I paid in federal taxes. I actually made the percentages out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
When I would work 38 to 40 hours a week, I would probably pay, you know, 11 or 12. But when I worked 31 to 30, in average, I could pay, you know, 12 or 14%.
And it just
goes into the point you were talking about before, you know. So that's all I wanted to say. Thanks a lot, Tom.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Andrew. Appreciate the call. It's the bottom line is Reaganomics is crazy. I mean, it's George Herbert Walker Bush, you know, bless his soul, was right. He had a moment of honesty. It was one of the few in his life, but he had a moment of honesty when he said that Ronald Reagan's economic policies were crazy and that they were voodoo economics. A lucid moment in the life of George Herbert Walker Bush. It should be enshrined forever. And I suspect will be. 57 minutes past the hour. We'll be back after the news. Tom.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Lisa De Pasquale is with us. She's the director, Tom Hartman here with you. She's the director of the American Conservative Union, conservative.org, the website. And Lisa, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me again.
It's been a while since we've talked. I hope I'm pronouncing your last name right.
Yes.
Because it's one of those ones where I say it in my head, I think, more often than I do. Okay. The American Conservative Union, this is one of the claims to be the nation's oldest and largest grassroots conservative lobbying organization. You've been raiding House members and Senate members since 1971, and the definitive conservative organization.
Yes, sir.
Okay, conservative and conservative.org for folks who want to check it out.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just try to, for the enlightenment of our listeners, try to define some of these issues and what it means to be conservative or liberal on some of the issues, if that's all right with you.
Sure, definitely.
Because, you know, we're coming into an election here and you know, you noted Republicans may lose not because voters prefer Democrats, but because Republican lawmakers, you know, are screwing up. It would be nice to break it down.
Okay.
Public versus private morality. This seems to me to be a big one.
I didn't hear it.
Public versus private morality.
Okay.
Liberals define morality, and I think historically Americans have defined morality, at least in the context of when to the extent to which government should be concerned about morality,
mm-hmm.
as basically those things that you find in Matthew 25 or the Sermon on the Mount. Are there hungry among us? Are there homeless among us? Are there sick among us? Are there poor among us? Are there thirsty among us? Are there those in prison among us unjustly? If that's the case, then we cannot claim ourselves to be a moral nation.
Mm-hmm.
That's the liberal worldview. And you saw, you know, Lyndon Johnson cut poverty in half in the United States in 4 years of the war on poverty. The conservative worldview seems to be, and I'd like to toss it to you for an explanation, but my understanding is that it is that private morality is really the higher and more important morality the government should worry about. Who's sleeping with whom, you know, what the laws are about who can have sex with whom, what religion can be practiced in the public square and how and those kinds of circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
That private morality is more important. Am I onto something here or missing something?
Well, I mean, for public morality, I mean, I would add that, you know, one thing that Bush has done is wanting to make funding and organizational aspects of it available to faith-based organizations who do want to do some of those things. Now, regarding private morality...
Well, let me just, if I may, speak to that. What that means, then, is that government is no longer doing those things. I mean, back in 1808, it must have been 1809 or 1810, the first year, first or second year that James Madison was president, his first veto was a veto of a bill that allocated money to the government of Washington, to a church in Washington, D.C., to provide for the poor. And he vetoed it because he said that if government ever starts giving money to faith-based organizations, to churches, that two dangers will incur. One is that they will start to want to influence the government to get more money, and you don't want that happening. And the second, and speaking as a Christian himself, he was most concerned about this, that the churches themselves will become corrupted, that they will be, you know, harmed by that. He said that that if the government has a mission of caring for the poor, and he believed that it did, that it should be the government itself that does that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the things that Katrina has shown us is that I think the government is not equipped to do a lot of things, including doing things on a local level. Now, whether, you know, I can't necessarily speak as to whether or not the churches would become corrupt or, as some might say, more corrupt, but... you know, I think it's at least something that should be looked at, and that you should be able, that the government should at least encourage those that want to do, you know, public morality sort of programs on a local level, that the government should at least encourage that rather than...
Well, we do that with tax breaks.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we nonprofit organizations don't have to pay taxes, and that's because we think that they're so important. They're such an important part of the fabric of America that we want to encourage them.
Mm-hmm. I guess my concern is that it's not that Republicans or conservatives don't have an idea that there should be a public morality. It just is a different approach to it.
Well, but isn't it that you don't believe that government should play a role in that public morality, that it should be private organizations that do it?
The federal government.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So then I'm accurately characterizing it.
Yeah, and to continue on to private morality, I don't know how all conservative groups feel, but the American Conservative Union carries that on to private morality. We are against the marriage amendment, and we do think that it is a state's issue rather than a federal government issue. And
in other words, you don't think that the federal government should be saying that gays can't get married, for example?
That's correct.
But you're saying that not out of a moral position, but out of a state's rights position, a constitutional position.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't really matter what our individual moral positions are, you know, just like it doesn't matter, you know, what our individual moral positions are regarding judges or anything like that. I mean, we don't think that the judiciary should figure it out or make decisions on who can get married, and we don't think the federal government should.
So, but the federal government does have hundreds of laws.
Mm-hmm.
That have to do with whether or not a person is married. For example, my wife can get Social Security survivor benefits. So that's a consequence of federal policy, federal law, that has to do with marriage. I mean, there are a lot of, and that's just, you know, one of obviously hundreds of areas where the position of the federal government on marriage has consequences in the real lives of real people.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, I think it would probably work the same way as it does for states that have varying age minimums for marriage. The federal government still has to acknowledge that marriage is there for any federal benefits.
Well,
but the federal government isn't putting an amendment in the Constitution as to whether or not there should be a national minimum age to get married.
Right. So you're arguing then that by the federal government not getting involved in this, those states that allow gay marriage, those gay marriages should be acknowledged by the federal government. Those states that forbid gay marriages, the non-marriages would not be recognized by the government.
That's correct.
If somebody tried to declare themselves married in a state that wasn't. But that's fundamentally a state's rights issue. I mean, you're back to the 10th Amendment with that, or the 9th
mm-hmm.
Amendment, rather.
Definitely.
Yeah. Okay. There's a lot of, on the conservative side, there's a lot of... shall we say, government bashing going on. I hear this a lot. Ronald Reagan, for example, here's his famous quote.
I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
And you kind of highlighted this with your discussion of Katrina.
Mm-hmm.
I always, you know, I was in the Soviet Union when it was the Soviet Union, and I lived on the East German border when it was East Germany. And I can tell you that, and I've worked in a number of third world countries that are run by despots and dictators. I've worked on the border with Burma, which is one of the very worst. And I can tell you that there are governments that are a them, an evil force. But I thought in the United States, the government was us.
Mm-hmm.
Why would we be opposed to us?
Well, I mean, I would probably grapple with the word choice. I don't know if I would say government, but I would probably say bureaucracy. You know, the bureaucracy was really the main problem with Katrina. And I mean the Katrina relief, not what happened to the city.
But that bureaucracy worked really, really well in Florida. I mean, in 2 years earlier in the election, just before the election of 2004, with Hurricane Charlie, which killed a few people,
mm-hmm.
the FEMA had hundreds of thousands of gallons of water pre-positioned. They had turkeys and hams pre-positioned.
Yeah, well, not just, I mean, when I say bureaucracy, I don't mean just the federal bureaucracy. I mean, local and state bureaucracies are the same. And you can definitely see in Katrina and the difference between Mississippi and Louisiana.
Well, yeah, they got wiped out, though. I mean, structurally, they just got wiped
mm-hmm.
out.
Well, I mean, Mississippi, they were leveled. It just, it wasn't flooded the same way.
Well, and also there wasn't a big city in Mississippi that got hit.
Mm-hmm. It was sort of the whole general area.
But I guess the point is how do conservatives view government? If liberals view government as a force that can do good in the world,
mm-hmm.
I don't want to put words in your mouth. what's your view of government?
I mean, I think the government should be there for the big things, for defense, for a lot of the organizational sort of things. You know, I mean, I'm not a constitutional scholar, but I mean, there are a lot of things like the Department of Education that I think where the bureaucracy hurts what's actually being done, where the department itself sort of runs its mission into the ground, just because the Department of Education is really there to, the National Department of Education is there to give a bunch of people jobs versus actually funneling money.
Aren't they there to support education, and we all benefit from having an educated populace?
That is why they're there, but they're also a huge bureaucracy that takes a lot of money as well.
You think they're not run well, in other words?
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. Lisa DePasquale, Lisa, can you stick around for a minute? I have one more question I'd like to carry forward on this one.
Sure.
If you can. Okay, great. We're talking with Lisa DePasquale. She's the director of the American Conservative Union. Conservative.org is the website. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. The website, TomHartmann.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. We'll be right back. 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartmann.
Nobody told me to be big like these. Nobody told me to be big like these. Nobody told me to be big like these. Green days indeed.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartmann here with you for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. We're talking with Lisa DePasquale. She's with conservative.org, the American Conservative Union. She's the director, conservative.org, the website. Lisa, let me just toss some stuff out. Well, actually, first of all, go ahead. You were going to say something?
No, I just said okay.
Okay. First of all, it seems to me from reading Russell Kirk's book, 1953 book, The Conservative Mind, which is the book that is still the Bible of the conservative movement. It's the book that got William F. Buckley going, it got Barry Goldwater going, got me going back when I was 13 years old.
Mm-hmm.
He starts out with his chapter about Edmund Burke, and then he gets into the notion that conservatives fundamentally don't like democracy. That if the majority of Americans are in favor of something like socialism, let's say social security, what Kirk defines as socialism, that the government should still not do that, even though the majority of the people want it. Because democracy is not the highest value here. The highest value here is the conservative worldview. Am I making sense?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I'm sure you know that we don't live in a democracy. We live in a representative republic. So I mean, it is sort of hard to take these euphemistic words like democracy and apply it to our form of government.
I assume you know where the separation of those two words came from?
I don't. Enlighten me, please.
Sure. In 1787, if you looked in a dictionary, democracy and republic, if you looked at democracy, it would have said see republic. If you looked at republic, it would have said see democracy.
Mm-hmm.
James Madison and Alexander Hamilton were trying to sell the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And so in Federalist number, as I recall, 24, maybe it's 14, James Madison invented this distinction where he said a republic is a nation of laws and a democracy is mob rule. And 20 years later, when he was president of the United States, he said, oh, we just made that up. This is a democracy. And in fact, he was then the head of the Democratic Republican Party, which is today known as the Democratic Party. And so, you know, it's really an artificial distinction. We, if you want to get real technical about it, we live in a constitutionally limited,
mm-hmm.
representative democratic republic.
Mm-hmm. But not a democracy in the sense that you were asking.
Well,
you know, if
a
majority of people
like,
were for socialism, then we would be socialists.
But yes, it is. I mean, because if the majority of the people, because we don't elect representatives to be leaders, we elect representatives to do what we want done for them. They're supposed to be representatives.
That hasn't worked out for us.
Well, I think to some extent it has. I'd say recently it has. And I mean, I have some really big concerns about George Bush signing a law that gives him the absolute right to declare you or me, you know, a threat to the country and put us in jail forever. By the way, where's the Conservative Union on that?
The Conservative Union was against the Patriot Act.
Okay, and so presumably you're against this detention bill as well.
That I don't know. I mean, I don't know anything about it, so I couldn't say either way on ACU's position or my own.
Okay. Conservatives have fought against child labor statutes. They fought against the concept of free public education. They fought against the right of women to vote for over 100 years in the United States. They fought against antitrust and anti-monopoly legislation and continue to. They fought against workers organizing. They defended Jim Crow for a long time. Although they were called the Democratic Party at the time, it was conservatives. They fought against voting rights, civil rights, Social Security, health care for the elderly, minimum wage. They fought to keep women as property, and now they fight for their right to sovereignty over women's bodies vis-a-vis abortion. They fight against environmental protection statutes. They oppose equal rights for gays and other lifestyle minorities. What are conservatives for?
Conservatives are for a limited government, and that
can
come.
But why?
Because we don't believe that the federal government should be involved in our everyday lives.
Well, that's a different thing than saying a limited government.
A limited federal government.
But why should the federal government not be involved in our everyday lives if that involvement works to our benefit and works to the benefit of this nation?
Because there are certain things that, you know, obviously are not things like national defense, where the government is not equipped to make decisions on people that have different local issues.
Well, certainly there's a lot of local issues that
mm-hmm.
should not be federalized. But
like education.
Well, you know, yeah, you're not going to get a lot of disagreement from me about education, but, and I'm not a big fan of the Department of Education, but, and particularly of the No Child Left Behind Act, but it seems that there are a whole lot of things, like Social Security, for example,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, when the Social Security law was passed in 1936, the leading cause of death among people over 60 in the United States in the winter was hypothermia.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, poverty was killing people, and Social Security ended that. Why would you want to do away with Social Security?
We don't want to do away with Social Security. We want to do away with the fact that you have no choice as far as whether or not you want the government to supposedly hold on to your money or whether you want to put it into other investments. I mean, most of the private retirement accounts.
That's how insurance works. Everybody pays into it. It's like, you know, mandatory car insurance. Everybody pays into it.
Yeah, but you have a choice whether or not you want to pay into an insurance company. But
no,
you don't have a choice if you want to.
I don't. If I want to drive a car, I have to buy insurance.
Well, it depends on what state you live in. You can also pay $200 a year, and then you don't have to buy insurance.
Apparently in a state I've not lived in. but the point is that, you know, what's wrong with this being an insurance program if it works?
Well, I think it's fine if people want to do it. I just think that you should be able to give people the choice. Some people would rather take a chance and invest it in the stock market. Some people would rather say, I want to spend my money now. And you know what? So if I'm making a bad decision, that's on me.
Okay. All righty. Well, it's an interesting conversation. Lisa DePasquale, thanks for coming on with us. Conservative.org, the website, the American Conservative Union.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be back right after this.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Power to the people!
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination, or at least a clean election. You know, we'd really settle for a clean election. We've been doing this, you know, what are conservatives all about in economics here up until this point, and I wanted to get into this whole Joe Republican rant and just kind of close this out. We've got a whole bunch of callers who want to talk about these issues. But in the meantime, yesterday we started out talking about how it looks like in Ohio and possibly three other states, according to this post over at the Daily Kos, what Greg Palast first exposed to the world back in 2000 for BBC, caging is going on. And so we thought we'd get the man on the line, Greg Palast, gregpalast.com. Welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hey, Tom. Glad to be with you. I don't know if I'm the man. I'm a man. Okay.
you're the man on a whole lot of issues, Greg, and the best-selling author of your newest book. That's a cue for you to give the title.
Armed Madhouse. Armed Madhouse, yeah. So anyway, what's happening here, I know that the Kos's blog was lit up yesterday with evidence or rumors or hearsay or whatever they've got that indeed in Ohio and other states, the Republican Party is sending out letters, and if you don't respond or if the letters come back undeliverable, you could be purged. And while it, you know, where was the evidence? The truth is that back in 2004, this is just a new twist on an old game that the Republican Party played in 2004 when they sent out, in one state alone, 70,000 letters. They must have sent out a million nationwide. They sent out letters to voters, and they were targeting such things as black soldiers. And when the letters came back undelivered, VOP! You got bopped off the voter registration list, or if you sent them an absentee ballot, it was thrown away, or you'd be challenged at the polls and given one of these bogus things called a provisional ballot, which doesn't get counted. So in other words, so there seems to be some basis for this information. That is, that they're playing the game again. Now, I would note that one thing I would ask people to do, don't mail in your ballot. If you think these guys can mess with the computers or anything else, if you then trust them to put that stamp on the letter, don't do it. Don't go postal.
Yeah. You know that. Yeah, you need to show up in person, unless you live in Oregon, where everybody votes by mail. Bob
right.
Petrakis and Harvey Wasserman yesterday posted over at commondreams.org an article where they said, and I quote, "In Ohio alone, four election boards have already eliminated some 500,000 voters since the 2000 election, 10% of the state's electorate, from the registration rolls in just four Democratic counties. No similar purges have occurred in rural Republican counties." And they go on to point out that the Democratic Party hasn't said a damn word about it.
Well, not only that, but you have some, like in Columbus, in the county there, in Franklin, we have the Board of Elections, which is a Democratic county. They're saying that people who end up on, where letters do go out, and they're marked undeliverable, and that's usually a clerical error. 90% of the time, it's a government clerical error. So because of that, you're not supposed to lose your registration. That's against federal law, and yet the County Board of Elections is saying that they're going to tell 150,000 people to vote on provisional ballots. And guess who gets to decide whether a provisional ballot gets counted, and that's the Secretary of State, a guy named Kenneth Blackwell, or his real name is Whitesick, but he's called Blackwell.
Are you... Oh, yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. Bad.
Okay.
Took me a minute to get it. Okay.
Yeah. No, it's about 11 seconds.
Yeah, there you go. So, Greg, we know this is happening in Ohio. This is probably happening right across the United States. These four states that this Republican insider said were, you know, where the fix is in.
Yes.
Any sense what these states may be?
Well, actually, I do know, for example, the caging lists we do know were going on in Ohio, in Florida, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania. Now, that's where I know that they were happening in 2004. Where they targeted in 2006, the RNC hasn't sent me a notice yet.
Yeah.
So we're still investigating. And that's one of the things I'm very frustrated because we're getting all this drumbeat, so we're trying to investigate to nail it down.
Right.
We do know, and this has been totally uncovered, not covered in the U.S. press, but we're covering it in England and the British press. 3 million new registrations were thrown in the garbage. So you have these huge mass registration drives. And despite, by the way, what people say, black folk register about try to register about 77% of the time, about 77% of the population, same as white people, but they get 20% of their registrations not entered onto the rolls. So you're having this massive blackout by knocking out the registration.
Why is that?
Well, how is that? A lot of that is, again, what we're finding is a tremendous amount of resistance when Jesse Jackson or others put forward bundles of registrants. They know who these are. Then they go through and they try to do what are called matches under a law that just began this January under a special provision of the Help America Vote Act, help us, that went into effect this January, which requires states to check new registrants' ID and verify the new ID. And some states are really using super tight criteria for some voters. In fact, the most mysterious thing is that in the state of Ohio, they won't even tell us what the criteria is. We've already known that 3 million new registrants have had their registrations tossed in the garbage, and very few of them realize this is happening. And they'll show up at the polls, they won't be registered, and they'll be handed a provisional ballot, and they think that they're voting, but that's a placebo ballot, and it'll be thrown out. Or they'll send in an absentee ballot, and it will be thrown in the garbage because their registration wasn't proper.
So do you think that when all is said and done, I mean, even if there is not a single rigged voting machine in this country, that when all is said and done, Karl Rove and George Bush are right, they're going to continue to have a Republican House and Senate because of these structural biases towards the Republicans,
let's put it this way, charitable. No, it's up to your listeners. They've got a 4 million vote sum on the scale. In other words, we've calculated that roughly it's about 4.6 million votes will be shoplifted in this election through knocking out legal registrants, challenging your vote, moving you to provisional ballots, et cetera, before you even get to any monkey business with the computers.
Right. So the only way we can win is to turn out 5 million more people than we would have had to normally turn out in a real election.
Yeah, we can do that.
Yeah, and we can do that.
Yeah,
there you go.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So, Don't whine, win.
Yeah, that's a great slogan, Greg Fallist. Don't whine, win. I agree. So the bottom line, no matter what state you live in, check to see if you are registered to vote. You can contact your Secretary of State's office.
Usually online.
Democrats.com actually has a system for doing this.
That's right. And make sure and try to and show up physically. Don't mail in your ballot to these guys, for God's sake. If you make one little mistake in the form that you sent in, they don't like the stamp you use, they don't like the way you licked it, They're gonna chuck your vote. So bring your vote in and try to use the early voting system so that if they say you can't vote or they try to give you a provisional ballot, you can come back. Most states allow early voting. Show up physically, show up early, vote early, vote often.
As Mayor Daley used to say.
Yeah, and don't let them muck with you. And by the way, another thing, besides don't mail in your vote, if you go and they say, oh, just fill out this provisional ballot even though there's a problem with your registration, don't do that. Demand a real ballot and demand adjudication by an election judge on the spot to get a real ballot. Another reason to go in and vote early. This is just basic voter protection, right?
Right. In other words, when you're standing there live and in person and they say, oh, we can't find you on the rolls, here's a provisional ballot you can fill out. That's a placebo ballot. You should instead say, no, I will not do a provisional ballot. I want a real ballot. And they say, well, were you not on the rolls? Then you say, then I challenge you. Somebody from the Secretary of State's office needs to show up right here, right now to prove to me why I'm not on the rolls, because I have in my hand my voter registration card
and
I have in my other hand my driver's license.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, and there's usually someone now. And by the way, guys, remember that. Take a look at your driver's license. Take a look at your voter registration card. You may note that they're slightly different. If they are, get ready for trouble. Get ready for a fight.
Right.
Call the Secretary of Office.
Exactly. Particularly if you live in a state with a Republican Secretary of State. If your driver's license says that you live on 123 Main Street, apartment 12, and your voter registration card says APT period 12, you probably just got caged.
Yeah. And let me tell you something, even if you're in a Democratic district, remember you're dealing with a party suffering from beaten party syndrome.
Yeah.
And, you know, they will often go along with their Secretary of State's ill rulings.
Yeah.
It's still America. You still have a right to vote, but you still have to fight for it.
Well said. Greg Pallas, gregpallas.com, the website. Greg, thanks for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Good talking with you. I truly appreciate it. Amazing what is going on. It's 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Paul in Bellevue, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I was listening to something earlier today, and I heard that the people who are voting in Ohio, they're voting early. They're allowed to vote early now, and they have
right.
R's and D's mixed up on their candidates. names on their ballots. And my concern was...
Oh, really?
When figuring out voter intent, are they going to, you know, be able to say, okay, well, in this case, he was voting for, you know, whoever the Republican candidate's name is. And in this case, we're going to go with the R, you know what I mean? Even though it's next to the Democratic candidate's name.
Oh, man, that's incredible. That's like Fox News saying that Mark Foley was a Democrat, you know? It's
right, exactly.
This is mind-boggling. I you know, that's a story that somehow slipped right by David and me. I'm sorry. I didn't know about that.
It was an informed citizen calling another show that I heard earlier who said, "Yeah, I'm in Ohio. We're getting these early ballots, and this is what's going on these ballots."
That's incredible.
So,
Paul, thanks for
the heads
up. I don't know, but we'll track this down and we'll find out here within the next 24 hours. I appreciate your call. Time for our progressive pop quiz here on the Tom Hartman program. Who is the first Republican to have officially announced his candidacy for president in 2008? He was on our show today. Sixth caller, 866-440-8466, gets a free copy of my book, Screwed, 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. We have a winner in our progressive pop quiz. Once again, our question was, who's the first Republican to have officially announced his candidacy for president in 2008? And congratulations to Paula Bradshaw in Carbondale, Illinois, listening on WINI. Congratulations, Paula. Applause there. Thank you, Clay. She knew that the correct answer is John Cox. And Cox2008.com is his website. And congratulations, Paula. Good on you for playing in our progressive pop quiz. Loaves and Fishes, Holy Ghost Victory for the GOP in November. This over at commondreams.org, you can check this out. The whole idea of the ways that the Republican Party is rigging the election right now, as we speak, in plain sight in most cases, and getting ready. In fact, we're going to be talking more about that right after the top of the hour with the author of How to Steal an Election, David Moore, a new book that's out as well. Nora in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Nora. Welcome to the program. Thanks for calling.
Well, hi there. I had to track down how to get a hold of you because we listen at 9 at night.
Oh, because they...
But I lost sleep last night because I'm so disturbed to hear about what some of these other states are like in their voting systems.
Here
in Minnesota, we have the highest voter turnout, and it's because we have a really good voter system, and that is the gold standard of allowing people to vote should be same-day voter registration. And any state who doesn't have that, they sound like a banana republic to me.
With their purging
and their, what do they call them, provisional? That's
right.
A bunch of fake garbage.
Yeah.
Provisional is nothing. You
yeah.
need to be same-day voter registration. If you're not on there, you can prove who you are that day, and you get to vote like a norm. Everyone should vote, whether their name is listed on some other list of something else. It doesn't matter. You still have the right to vote.
Amen, Paul, or Nora. The voter registration laws, in most cases, go back to a time 100 years or more ago when people had, you know, people didn't have driver's licenses, and in order to establish that you were a legitimate voter might take some time. You had to find somebody to vouch for you, you know. Plus, the whole thing of voter registration was also a way of keeping particularly minorities, particularly African Americans, keeping people who the establishment didn't want to vote, and frankly through most of the 19th century and early 20th century, it was the Democratic Party actually that was doing more of this than the Republicans, who didn't want you to vote, off the voting rolls. And you're right, you're absolutely right. Same day voter registration is the solution to the problem. Do you know if any other states besides Minnesota have same day voter registration?
I think there's about I can't remember. I heard of a list one time where there's about four of them or something.
Yeah.
I'm not sure, but I don't understand why anyone could call themselves a democracy and then say you can't vote because of some list somewhere.
Because you didn't send in a paper a week ago. Yeah, well, we'll have David will track down what states have same-day voter registration. We ought to create a nationwide campaign for this. This should become a national campaign issue.
I mean, why don't these other states know about it? Why don't they have it?
Good question. Good question. I'm on it.
Thanks.
Nora, thanks a lot for the call.
I love you. Bye now.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. Bonnie in Burgettstown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bonnie, what's on your mind today?
Well, I'm calling about your first guest, John Cox.
Yes, the Republican running for president.
Right. I'm always amazed how people who work in the financial industry and they make six figures or more, they love to imply that they understand the economy as if Wall Street's the entire economy.
Well, he actually tried to say that.
Yeah, I know. And I learned something from Howard Zinn at one of his talks here in Pittsburgh 4 years ago. I just love him. And he said very slyly and charmingly, nobody is an expert in the big things. We're only experts in the small things. And his context was how his detractors have always told him that he's only a history professor, so he shouldn't be advocating on economic and social issues. So that's bogus. But I guess the Dominionists would be qualified to address economic and social issues.
Well, let me just add to that, though, if I may, Bonnie. Bill Clinton yesterday made this joke. Actually, he made it when he was in Seattle at the gig that I emceed a couple of months ago. He said, that he had grown up in an alcoholic family. He'd spent most of his life trying to get into the reality-based world, and he rather likes it here. I think that we should simply look at evidence. If you look at the evidence over the last 230 years in the United States, those times when progressives ran this country and we had legislation and laws that encouraged and strengthened democracy and a middle class, we had a strong middle class and we had relative stability and, by and large, peace. And during those times when we had conservatives and conservative economic policies ruling this nation, we had the middle class getting wiped out and you had a large rise in the working poor.
Oh, definitely. And like Nora said, don't you know if I'm Miss Minnesota? I just love that accent. You have to remember that I think the progressive movement started there. I just wish it would spread like prairie fire all over the nation. And we do need to have that same-day registration. But speaking of Dominionists, that reminds me to address a phone call you got a couple of days ago near the end of your program. And the caller was looking for a video clip of Paul Warwick. I know where you can find it. That clip is edited into a short lecture on the rise of Reconstructionists at a great academic, but it's a very understandable website, and it's called theocracywatch.org.
Ah, I've had the founder, I'm forgetting her name. I've had her on this program twice. She's brilliant. She's
Joan
absolutely brilliant.
Care, I think is her name.
Yeah, theocracywatch.org is
just fabulous. Google the rise of Dominionism, and it's the second entry on the list of the search.
Great. Thank you, Bonnie.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Much appreciated. Yeah, DominionWatch.org is, TheocracyWatch.org, excuse me, is an amazing, amazing website. We should get Joan back on again. You know, because it's been probably 6-8 months since she's been on the program, maybe even a year. 57 minutes past the hour. Coming back on the other side of the hour, we're going to be talking with David Moore about how to steal an election. Patty Wetterlening is going to be here. She's running for Congress from Minnesota's 6th District. And Lamar Waldron on some information that the CIA has let out. You'll find it amazing. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
So you want to steal an election, eh? Well, there's now a handy guidebook. It's actually more of a history. The subtitle, The Inside Story of How George Bush's Brother and Fox Network Miscall the 2000 election and change the course of history. David W. Moore is with us David Moore, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, thanks, Tom. I appreciate it.
Your website, I should let our listeners know, for those who like to track things down on the Internet, davidwmoore.us, M-O-O-R-E is how you spell your last name, and the book, How to Steal an Election. You're focusing in this book on the 2000 election of Al Gore versus George W. Bush.
Right.
What is the main mechanism that was used to steal the 2000 election?
What is the main mechanism?
Yeah, that the Republicans used.
Well, there's a variety of things that the Republicans did, starting off with a felon disenfranchisement program in Florida. The Jeb Bush administration hired a special company to supposedly remove felons from the registered voter list that shouldn't have been allowed to vote. But the way they did it, they actually removed 50,000 names of people who were entitled to vote, which were later put back on the voter registration list, but only after the election. And though those 50,000 voters, more than half were black, they were mostly from Democratic areas, it's clear that Gore would have won the election in Florida had those people been allowed to vote, and he would have won by 20,000-30,000 votes.
Yeah.
But on election night, I mean, that wasn't enough, because what they really did was essentially take away those votes, so it was very, very close. But on election night 2000, which is where I focus on, what happened is that the Fox Network called the race for Bush in Florida, and thus the new president of the United States, about 2:15 in the morning. And they did so because Jeb Bush was talking with the guy who was at Fox Network, John Ellis. That was his cousin. John Ellis was the head of the decision team deciding whether or not to call the race. And
Jeb Bush is talking to his cousin over at Fox News?
Yes, that's right. And they're supposed to be, you know, evaluating the data that's provided to them at that time by an organization called Voter News Service. All the networks, all the five networks plus the Associated Press were getting data on the election, on election night, from Voter News Service. But, in fact, what we know now, based upon the statistician who's sitting right next to John Ellis throughout the election night, is that when he called it, he announced it by saying, Jebby says we got it, Jebby says we got it. And with that excited announcement to his colleagues, they went ahead and called the race. And then what I did was interview the other decision teams, people on the other decision teams, and it's very clear that NBC called it just because Fox did. They were close to calling it, but the Voter News Service, the one providing the data, was trying to say, no, you can't, you know, it's way too close to call. We shouldn't be calling it, but just as soon as Fox did, NBC went ahead and did it anyway. Right after that, CBS and CNN did it. I was with the decision team there. ABC didn't want to call it. At least the decision team didn't want to, but an ABC executive overrode them and called it so that their network wouldn't look foolish, which is ironic.
Yeah.
And so that left the Associated Press, which did not call it, nor did DNS, which was the overall organization.
That was supposed to call it.
No, they weren't supposed to. It was too close to call. They,
right.
They stampeded into doing so, and oddly enough, by Jeb Bush himself.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Now, here's a fact that I'd like to talk about on this program from time to time. I think probably our listeners are familiar with it, but most Americans are not, that a year after the election, in fact, a year and a month after, actually it was more than that. It was in November of 2001.
One, right.
So it was a month after 9/11.
Right.
So it was exactly a year after the election. In November of 2001, this consortium of newspapers, so the Gannett and the Washington Post and the New York Times and there were a few other a few other agencies that were in there, they actually sent trailers down to Florida and they collected all of the ballots, the actual physical paper ballots, and sat down and counted them. And they counted them three times, and they counted them looking at every possible which way. You know, intent
right.
voter, dangling chads, dimpled chads, pimpled chads, you know, pregnant chads, falling chads, dead chads.
Yeah, right. They did a thorough job of differentiating one approach from another.
Right. And the conclusion that they came to, and this was published in the New York Times and the Washington Post, but in the New York Times they buried it literally in the 17th paragraph of the story, was that no matter what criteria you used, intent of the voter, chads, no chads, undervotes, overvotes, whatever, no matter what criteria you used, if you counted every single vote in the state of Florida, every single legal, legitimate vote in the state of Florida, Al Gore won Florida.
That's right. That's what they said. Unfortunately, though, as you know, what the newspapers did was in their headlines, they highlighted and they said, well, suppose there had been only a limited recount. The original request by Al Gore was for a limited recount, although by the time it got to the Supreme Court, it was for a full recount.
The entire state, yeah.
But he said, suppose only the limited recount went, well, then George Bush probably still would have emerged victorious. But the problem with that kind of headline is that was an irrelevant consideration,
right.
Because by the time the Supreme Court had ruled against them, they were already trying to do a full recount in the state of Florida.
Right, but I just heard just not a month and a half ago, I heard Rush Limbaugh say, "Well, everybody knows that when they finally counted the vote, George W. Bush won Florida. So I don't know what these guys are whining." You know, I mean, they're still flogging that meme. These guys on the right, the Republicans by and large, are still flogging the notion that George Bush actually won the 2000 election, whether or not the Supreme Court intervened. And the fact of the matter is that the Supreme Court stopped the count of the vote in Florida. And in his ruling, Rehnquist, who wrote judgment decision, whatever, in this, he said that the plaintiff, George W. Bush, the man, you know, bringing forth the lawsuit, the plaintiff would be, quote, irrevocably harmed, end quote, if the counting of all the votes in the state of Florida was allowed to continue. Now, what kind of irrevocable harm could there be that Rehnquist knew about and ruled on in order to stop the vote? The harm would be that he wouldn't be elected president.
Well, yeah, and I think there was that's part of the argument that I make in the book itself, is that with the networks calling the election at 2:15 in the morning, it actually prompted Al Gore to concede the election. And then, of course, he had to unconcede about an hour later before he actually made, you know, public announcement. But he had already conceded, and it was widely known that he had conceded to George W. Bush. So when they got down to Florida after Al Gore had unconceded, the Republicans were all in a tizzy because they were treating Al Gore as though he was trying to steal the election. And
right.
Fox was just rabid on this, constantly challenging him. But even in the mainstream media, that is, you know, like Tim Russert called on Al Gore to concede, when in fact, you know, it was the other way around, that it should have been George
right.
W. Bush.
And down in Florida, there was James Baker leading this team. And you had John Roberts, who is now the head of our Supreme Court. He was down there, the head of a legal team, prepping, because he used to be the clerk for Justice Rehnquist, and so he knew what, you know, how to best argue in front of Rehnquist. He was prepping the lawyers who were going to take the case to the Supreme Court to stop the vote count in Florida. You had John Bolton down there, who is now our ambassador to the United Nations. He was leading the banging on the window crowd. You had Tom DeLay's entire office staff down there. It was supposed to look like an uprising of Floridians who were outraged, and it was all Republicans from Washington, D.C. who had been flown in on private jets.
And one of the things, that's true, and one of the analyses that was done was of Judge Arthur Kennedy's vote, because Justice David Souter said in a speech after everything was over that if he'd had just one more day, he might have been able to convince Kennedy not to go with the majority, but to go with the other side and order the recount continued. But the analysis suggested that Kennedy was very concerned about the political turmoil. And the political turmoil that was down there was in large part created by Republicans, a lot of whom really were very upset that Gore had conceded and unconceded, and they were treating him as though he was the real loser and that he had flip-flopped. And
yeah.
I think had there been at the end of the night the network saying it's too close to call, it would have been a different political environment, and I think we would have seen a different result.
So it was Jeb Bush's cousin, George Bush's cousin at Fox News, who flipped the entire election in 2000.
Yeah, and it was
David,
kind of
David, we're out of time, David, but How to Steal an Election is the book. People can pick it up and learn all about it. The inside story, how George Bush's brother in Fox Network called it. David W. Moore, 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Now listen. I watched the news last night on TV. Another scandal up here in D.C. Jack Abramoff, Duke Cunningham, and Tom DeLay. Well, there's a new one most every other day. You got Halliburton camped out in the lobby, making handshake deals behind closed doors. You better do something fast about the price of gas, cause I've been paying for mine and for yours, and I'm taking my country back.
That's what we have to do, my friends. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. We have to take our country back, and we have to do it one congressional district at a time. Some time ago, Congressman Bernie Sanders is on this program every Friday, has been for the last 3 years. So a caller called up and said, Bernie, what can I do? You know, should I send money to the DNC? Should I send money to the DCCC? What do I do? And he said, find candidates that you believe in, particularly if your candidate is solid. Find candidates around the country you believe in and go to their websites and give them $25 or $50 or $10 or whatever you can afford, $100, $1,000, whatever you can afford, and help them out. Get them going. And so every week on this program, we've been trying to get at least one and generally more than one. Good progressive candidates on that we can talk to for a brief period of time, introduce them to all of you all across the United States, and give them a chance to say hi. Patty Wetterling is with us today in our Taking Back America segment. She's a candidate for Congress in Minnesota's 6th District. Her website, Patty Wetterling, WETTERLING.com. And Patty Wetterling, welcome.
Thank you, Tom. I'm glad to be here.
Great to have you here with us. Patty, we had a conservative on the program earlier this morning who was saying Social Security should be replaced by a voluntary savings program. What are your thoughts on that?
We need to protect Social Security and make sure it stays secure. It would be better off if we didn't keep borrowing from the trust fund. No, I don't. That's not going to work. We have a successful program. We've got to protect Social Security.
Yeah, it has never failed to make a check. Some of the other, I'd just like to go through what you consider to be the priorities for Minnesota's 6th District and for the United States. The war in Iraq.
A year ago, I was one of the first candidates in the nation to say we need to bring our troops safely home. I still call that. I suggested then if we began that we could have them home by Thanksgiving of 06. We haven't yet begun. We've got generals around the nation saying it's time to bring them home, and we need to do that. But then we also need to care for them. We're not fully funding VA hospitals. Many of them come home and they don't have health care. It's unconscionable to me that we're expecting them to go over there and put their lives on the line and then not care for them when they come home. We've got our work cut out.
One of the biggest problems that I see across the United States, Patty Wetterling, is the problem of small businesses being wiped out by both, on the one hand, the forces of monopoly and consolidation, what was, you know, illegal back before Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1881 in 1982. It only lasted 101 years. And on the one hand, and on the other hand, just, you know, the ravages of an economy that is tilted so heavily toward the very, very wealthy, since most small businesses are started by middle class folks. You have small business as part of your agenda. I think this is great. Tell us about it.
Well, I actually grew up, my dad was a pharmacist. I grew up in a corner drugstore, and we had to survive when, you know, the Walmarts and Kmarts and everybody else started selling pharmaceuticals, and we did that. My husband's a chiropractor, so we have a small business in St. Joseph, Minnesota. I care deeply. I believe that the middle class is part of the engine that drives this country, and right now that's what I'm hearing the very most is the economic squeeze of the middle class, and certainly with small business. We've got to fix health care, which I've been meeting with small business people who want to provide health care for their employees, and it's just becoming a bigger and bigger challenge. So there's a lot that we've got to do that we're giving all these corporate tax breaks to the largest corporations, and we've got to find some initiatives to help out small businesses.
We're talking with Patty Wetterling. She's running for Congress in Minnesota's 6th District. Her website, Patty Wetterling, W-E-T-T-E-R-L-I-N-G, P-A-T-T-Y, wetterling.com, if you'd like to check it out. Education, you're a former teacher.
I am a teacher. I taught secondary math, and I believe that that's the very hope of this nation. If we do not educate our youth, we have no future. We've got to make it a priority. We can't keep passing legislation, having these unfunded mandates coming from Washington. My daughter teaches special education and has, gosh, she and another teacher have 17 really highly needs kids in their classroom. It's just wrong. We've got to make it more of a priority. That's our future in this country.
It seems to me that the conservatives who want to privatize education are pursuing the exact same path that they did down in, you know, with Hurricane Katrina. You break a federal program, and then when it doesn't work, or even a state or local program for that matter, education, you break the program, and then when it doesn't work, you stand around, point out, and say, "See, it's broken."
Yes, my opponent, this is even worse here. My opponent is out to destroy the Department of Education. She believes in homeschooling children, and none of her kids have gone to public schools, and she's really, really out to get. She's voted against any of the funding as a state senator.
Yet free public education is what provides the basis for a middle class.
Well, absolutely, and I can't even imagine what we would be as a democracy if we did not educate our people. It's a very dangerous place to be, and
yeah.
We're starkly different on most issues, but this is one that's really key.
Yeah, indeed. In fact, Thomas Jefferson started the University of Virginia as a free college because he felt that was the key to social and economic mobility, and that's what's on his tombstone, at his request, not that he was president, but that he started the University of Virginia. Patty Wetterling, Patty Wetterling, PattyWetterling.com, the website. Patty, thank you for being with us today.
We got to take back this country. Thank you so much.
There you go. And she's running for Congress in Minnesota's 6th District. Check out her website. Toss her some help here. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. When they tortured and scared you for 20-odd years, then they expect you to pick a career. When you can't really function, you're so full of fear. A working class hero is something to be.
There you go, and we can all be heroes. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where despair is not an option. Get active! By the way, Lauren at Air America, our call screener, Lauren Kirshner, says that Minnesota, Maine, New Hampshire, Idaho, Wisconsin, Wyoming, Montana, and North Dakota are the states that have same-day registration, or in the case of North Dakota, no registration to vote. And this is great information. I did not know the detail. You know, I knew that it was happening, but thanks so much to our caller earlier from Minnesota with that information. So, who killed John Kennedy? And perhaps more to the point, why is the CIA still covering up millions of pages of information, millions of documents? Why was information kept from committees that were trying to investigate the Kennedy assassination and trying to investigate things like Iran-Contra? Lamar Waldron with us. He is the author. I am the co-author of Ultimate Sacrifice, a new book. Well, actually, it was the original hardcover came out. When did it come out, Lamar?
Last year.
Yeah. Okay. Last year. The paperback is out now, and it is radically different. It's an updated edition with dramatic new revelations. The subtitle: John and Robert Kennedy, the plan for a coup in Cuba, and the murder of JFK. Hey, Lamar, welcome to the program.
Great to be here, Tom. It's just like old times, back when we were working on the case together.
There you go. Yeah. for many long years, actually. UltimateSacrificeTheBook.com is the website if you want to check that out. And Lamar, let's just you know, go through this stuff, and we'll do, like, you know, an interview show kind of thing here. There was a coup, an invasion plan that Kennedy had put together for that actually had some political calendar associated with it, wouldn't you say?
Sure. Yeah, it was all set for December 1, 1963, just 10 days after JFK would have gotten back from Dallas. And it took America 40 years to hear about that. We wrote about that in the hardback. But the big new information that's in the trade paperback that's just coming out this week, and this explains why not only so much was kept secret for so long, but one reason that even a million documents, CIA documents alone, are still secret today is, okay, John and Robert Kennedy getting ready to stage this palace coup in Cuba that will be followed by a U.S. invasion. Maybe just a few hundred special forces, Cuban exiles, up to a full-scale invasion if needed, they said. And they were using the number three man in Cuba at the time, Commander Juan Almeida, the commander and founder of the Cuban Revolutionary Army. Now, that name in this context...
To this day, by the way.
I'm sorry, what was that again?
To this day. I mean, the CIA right now lists him as the number three guy in Cuba behind Raul Castro.
Right, and that is the big secret that has been protecting so much information for so long, both legitimately and illegitimately. Because, of course, when you're working with the number three guy in Cuba in November 1963 and the coup plan doesn't happen because JFK gets killed, you can't just sacrifice that man in Cuba and sacrifice any chance of the democracy that John and Robert Kennedy were hoping to have follow that coup, because it wasn't going to be just to install a strong man. It was going to lead to eventual provisional government and free elections. But Juan Almeida, the commander of the Cuban army, remained high in Cuba for years, and as you just said today, if people go to the CIA website, he's listed number three right under Raul Castro, and with Fidel having temporarily stepped aside, technically that makes Commander Juan Almeida, JFK's ally, the number two man in Cuba today. But, of course, the real story is a lot more complicated than that.
Now I have a real clear recollection, Lamar, of back when you and I were doing the research, the initial research on this book in the 1980s.
Sure.
And we were jetting all over the planet, and I had finally tracked down Harry Williams, who was part of the Bay of Pigs invasion and was our first and primary informant. He laid a lot of this information out for us. And he led me to a couple of other people, led both of us to a couple of other people. But I had this meeting with this guy who was highly placed in the U.S. military. And when I said Almeida's name to him, and keep in mind, this was, what was this, 16 years ago?
I believe you had that meeting in 1992.
Okay, 1992. Whatever, I can't do math that fast. 14 years ago, yeah. That he grabbed me and stuck his finger in my chest and said, if I ever said that name out loud again, I would be executed. I would be shot for treason. And in fact, we did not include that name in the original hardback edition of the book. We spent a lot of time explaining why we had to keep this guy's name covered up. And we didn't just include that name in the documentary that NBC did that ultimately showed on, was it Arts and Entertainment or Discovery Channel? It was Discovery Channel, wasn't it?
It actually showed on Discovery. In fact, it shows on Discovery Channel Canada tomorrow night at 9 o'clock. It's not now listed on the Discovery Channel America site for November, but I'm sure if enough people go to the DiscoveryChannel.com website and request that Conspiracy Files JFK assassination be shown, maybe it will make it on the schedule.
So here's the question. Why did we keep his identity secret for 14 years? Why did the U.S. government finally decide to essentially allow us to make this information public? And why should that matter to anybody today? Why should we care? In other words, you know, what, for example, what do, because we only have like 4 minutes left here, what do Rumsfeld and Cheney, for example, have to do with all this? What does John Kerry have to do with it? What does this have to do with today's political scene as well? Let me just toss all that at you and just let you go with it.
Sure. Well, the reason that people, starting with Secretary of State Dean Rusk, first started telling us about JFK's secret coup plan, Dean Rusk started doing that in 1990, without using Commander Almeida's name in 1992, we got Commander Almeida's name finally, was that Castro, Fidel Castro, finally learned about Commander Almeida's role in 1990. Almeida was no kind of double agent. Barbara Kennedy and the CIA were certain of that. Fidel suspected Che Guevara of Almeida's friend, not Almeida himself. So Fidel didn't find out until 1990 when one of Almeida's former subordinates ratted him out. At that point, Almeida disappeared for several years. It was assumed he was dead, but that's why the people we talked to were willing to tell us about him. But even then, just on the slight chance he might still be alive, they impressed upon you and myself how secret-sensitive this was. Then, in 1995, Commander Almeida reappeared on the scene as if nothing had happened. No explanation ever given. The reason Castro has allowed Commander Almeida to rejoin the government and still he enjoys a high position today is because today, just as in 1963, he was the highest black official in the Cuban government. Up to 70% of the Cuban population is of African descent. So Fidel's not black, Raul wasn't black, Che wasn't even a Cuban. Almeida was very important in 63 for that reason. He's just as important today in terms of outreach to Africa, the Third World.
Why are we allowed to say his name now, and we would have gone to jail a year ago? And what does this have to do with today?
Well,
in 2 minutes or less, Lamar.
To answer the first question is, Commander Almeida's family is safe. And so that's one reason we can talk about him now. We didn't want to endanger his family. They got out of Cuba with the aid of Robert Kennedy and the CIA in the fall of 1963, and they never went back to live. So we were able to confirm last spring they were still outside of Cuba. They were safe. The CIA finally realized in 2001 that Fidel definitely knew about Commander Almeida's work. They had tried an outreach to him in the late 1990s. In 2001, they realized he could no longer be of assistance to them. So apparently that was one factor, and then enough documents had slipped through that the decision was made, not by us, but by the U.S. government last year, that his name could finally be made available to the public. Now, this has tremendous implications for people today, obviously, in Cuba, where we're looking at a transition of power, finally, in terms of Fidel Castro, but the secrecy has affected so much else for so long, because a lot of the intelligence failures in the weeks and months before 9/11 that the FBI and the CIA had are right out of the intelligence failures from the fall of 1963 that we can see and we talk about in the documents, and we show some of the documents at ultimatesacrificethebook.com, where these intelligence failures allowed JFK's assassination to happen. Because those intelligence failures from 63 were never exposed, problems were never fixed, so the same agencies kept making the same mistakes for the next 40 years. Even in Iraq today, several of the U.S. coup attempts against Saddam Hussein in the 1990s failed for exactly the same reasons that JFK and Almeida's coup plan failed.
In other words, when are we going to learn our lesson?
That's exactly right. We're going to keep repeating the lessons of history until we learn them, but finally we've got this information out in our book. And here's something very important for your listeners. Another reason they should vote is 1 million CIA files alone, and those are files, not pages, God knows how many pages, are still being kept secret today. Despite a 1992 law, the JFK Act, unanimously passed by Congress, that said they should all be released. A judge just threw out a recent lawsuit seeking those documents. So your listeners should definitely vote. They should ask their congressmen and senatorial candidates to be accountable. And again, we have the information about this if they go to ultimatesacrificethebook.com and click on the link that says Tell Congress, and they can find all about what's being withheld from Congress today.
Great. And I wrote a piece about this that you'll see out in the blogosphere in the next few hours, hopefully. Lamar Waldron, ultimatesacrificethebook.com.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
I want the America my daddy used to know, where right was right and not political code, where leaders in D.C. respected you and me, the America my daddy taught to me.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Listener-supported radio, supported by our listeners, supporting our sponsors. Sacred Grounds Coffee, for example, saving the planet one cup at a time. 1-800-425-2532 is their phone number, sacredgroundscoffee.com, their website. And Small Dog Electronics, get the latest iPods now, 1-800-511-MAX, smalldog.com, their website. Check them out. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and please support your local sponsors and let them know that you heard their ads on this program. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan, WTKG.
Yes.
Hey, Rick, what's up?
Well, Tom, I saw you over the weekend on C-SPAN. Good presentation.
Well, thank you. It is playing again, by the way, on Saturday at 3:30 Eastern Time, noon 30 Pacific Time, and variations in between.
Kind of surprised that, because I know how old you are, but I won't say, but you look like a very young man, and you're in good shape, and, you know, you're taking care of yourself, obviously.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I'm definitely in my 50s here. So.
Well, I am, too. A little older than you. But anyway, you know, when I heard the Greg Palast interview, it made my blood boil about the 2000 election. But, you know, that's past, and looking forward now, have you heard this rumor or whatever they call it on the Internet or whatever about some NFL stadiums are under threat this weekend?
There was a blog posting about that. The Department of Homeland Security, you know, got on it. They notified everybody about it. The question in my mind is this the same thing as, remember Tom Ridge saying on the on several different media after the 2004 election that he couldn't figure out why about every other week the Karl Rove's office would tell him to raise the threat level, and you know every time John Kerry got some traction the threat level went up. And is this, you know, is this the Bush administration trying to scare the hell out of everybody, or is this, just some crackpot thing? I mean, or are they using a crackpot thing to scare the hell out of everybody? My guess is, well, actually, the way that we'll find out is when we find out where the story originated. In other words, did this leak from the Department of Homeland Security, or did it leak someplace else? My guess is, though, that the Department of Homeland Security is once again being politicized.
Well, my question is, though, that if indeed they've got it out now so they can say they warn people, and if something does happen, especially if it happens at more than one stadium, could it, you know, be that the Republicans think, well, this will help us win because now it'll show that, you know, we need Republicans to keep us safe, even though that seems counterintuitive. On the other hand, it could even go so far, let's say it happened at 6 or 8 stadiums. You know, they could even declare martial law and say, sorry, we can't have an election right now. Could it go that far?
You know, it's not inconceivable, and that's one of the big concerns that everybody has, is that the Bush administration now has the power, these emergency powers. And, in fact, there's you know, it even gets weirder, and that is this new piece of, or this rider that was attached to the defense appropriation bill that says that Bush can grab the National Guard from one state, send them to another state, and tell them to do whatever he wants them to do. I mean, that's something that we didn't even know about. And it's just, you know, just today is coming out. And this is from a bill that was passed 3 weeks ago. And now Bill, you know, Bill O'Reilly out here doing his, you know.
So all those clowns over at the liberal radio network, we could incarcerate them immediately. Will you have that done, please? Send over the FBI and just put them in chains?
I mean, these guys are gleeful.
Well, this is a classic frog in the pan thing, isn't it? I mean, it's happening incrementally, and before we know it, we won't have a free country anymore.
There you go. Then the pan is getting hotter and hotter and hotter.
I know you're doing a good fight, so keep it up.
Okay, thanks a lot, Rick. I appreciate the call. Good to hear from you. Dave in St. Paul, Nebraska, is it?
St. Paul, Nebraska, yes. It's Dave.
Hey, Dave, what's up?
Keep up the good work, Tom. We really need you.
Thank you.
My question was this, Don Cox, is he any relationship to the Cox Cable Telecommunications Network?
David, my producer, has been looking for this. He's been poking around the Internet here for the last 15, 20 minutes right on that question. And we're talking about Cox, who's the cousin to Jeb and George Bush, who called the election for Fox News in 2000. And, David, what did you find?
I couldn't find any relation.
You couldn't find any relation. Yeah. So we're not sure, but it doesn't look like there's a relationship between the two.
Okay, great. Well, I just thought that'd be a good end for somebody that happens to own cable or networks.
Yeah, no, I really don't think it is. The Cox Communications is an old Atlanta family, as I recall. I mean, I used to live in Atlanta, and they were pretty ubiquitous. But whether, I don't know, maybe he married, I just don't know. I just don't know, bottom line. But it doesn't look like it. There's no clear and obvious connection.
Okay. Also, did you get a line on the other four states that might be trying to disenfranchise Democrats?
No, we're still looking for that information.
Okay.
Although good guess, Pennsylvania would be among them. I would put that at fairly high probability, but you know we're going to see how this thing shakes out. So,
okay.
Thanks a lot for the call, Dave. Keith in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Keith, we have less than a minute to go. What's up?
Yeah, one thing was the Missouri Supreme Court today voted 6-1 against that state's new law about voter ID.
Oh, good.
It said it would impose a heavy and substantial burden on Missourians' free exercise
of
suffrage.
Yes, I have that story in my stack here that I haven't gotten to yet.
And the other thing is, in Ohio, an activist is going to file an injunction tomorrow to try to stop all those letters, the disenfranchising of all those people.
Yep, Bob Petrakis is filing a lawsuit. Rob Call wrote about it over at opednews.com. You can.
The other thing is, my question is, why are there no exit polls this year?
Well, there may be. There are people, Election Defense Alliance, velvetrevolution.us, voterAction.org. There's a number of organizations that are trying to organize exit polls. So, I'd say check them out and help them out if you possibly can. C-SPAN on Saturday, airing my new book, Screwed, Saturday, 3:30 p.m. I'll be at Bioneers. I'll be on the Laura Flanders Show Saturday night from Bioneers. Tomorrow, Peter B. Collins filling in for me. Check him out. Thanks for being with us. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
And remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it.